my God. My name is Terry Cruz, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Terry.
I want to thank you, Atlanta, for that warm welcome. I don't think I've ever had it quite like that before. You guys are enthusiastic this morning. I got a couple of pleasantries I want to get through real quickly before we dive into this thing. The first person I want to thank is Meredith for the call, for inviting me to come down here to Atlanta. It's an honor and a privilege to get to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank you for that. I want to thank Izzy for driving me from the airport here yesterday. And I want to thank my hostess, Lauren. And she's so sweet. And she's always like, do you need anything? Do you need anything? Like, I'm really no low maintenance. Just tell me where I'm supposed to be. My friend Doug, I don't think Doug made it back this morning. Is he here? Doug. Yeah, he didn't make it back, but that's okay. My friend, he's actually a friend from Texas. He's a transplant into Atlanta. He came Friday and took me out to lunch, and we went over step 6 and 7 because my ego had me so scared about what I was going to do. And then I want to thank my friend John for coming, an old friend from Ohio who's here. I've enjoyed my time with him. And then my friends from Virginia Beach, Mike and Kelly. It's been an honor and a privilege to get to spend time with you again, and I hope we can do it in Hawaii. And then a couple more little things I want to do. I want to apologize to Damon. Yesterday, a question was asked during the 6 and 7 workshop. I didn't hear the question. He was way in the back of the room. I didn't hear the question. And Rich, the Friday night speaker who did the workshop with me, since he's not here, I will take this opportunity to throw him under the bus. he had one job. One job, and his job, actually he had two. One was to talk about step 6, but the other job that he had was to take the questions from the audience and speak them into the microphone so we would get them onto the tape so that the listener could hear it and understand it. So when he translated that question, what Rich said was not the same question that was asked. So the answer was different, so I want to apologize to him. And lastly, being the Sunday morning speaker makes for a very long weekend. You know, I've been doing this a long time, and I still get nervous. I still get antsy in my seat. I don't know if that's ever going to change. My sponsor says that's a sign of humility, and she hopes that never goes away. So there you have it. But anyway, so I grew up in a small town in northwest Ohio, a little town called Woodville. We're about 15 minutes east of the city of Toledo. I grew up in the 1970s. There wasn't a whole lot happening in Woodville. There wasn't a lot of trouble to get into. If anybody said the word heroin, everybody went, oh, my God. I mean, it was just so shocking. And, of course, it has a whole new face on it today. And so I had a pretty, what I thought was a normal childhood, but I had a grew up in a single-parent home. I had an older sister named Pam. And in my childhood, it was basically me and Pam because my mother was a bartender. So she was leaving for work when I was coming in from school. And then she was returning from work to 2:30 in the morning when I was sound asleep. So when I reflect back on my childhood, I don't have warm, fuzzy memories of everybody gathered around the dinner table. I remember me and Pam and fighting, and I just don't remember a lot of structure and guidance. I don't remember having consequences, being grounded, any of that kind of stuff, which probably would have done me well. But one thing about me that sticks out in my mind is I always felt like I was different. Always felt like there was something about me that was different. Like, you all had this path to life. You all knew something that I didn't know. And I always felt awkward in social situations. And I still today sometimes feel like that, believe it or not. I always felt like a square peg trying to squeeze into a round hole. I just could not fit. And at age 16, I know I'm a late bloomer. At age 16, I was introduced to alcohol, and the very first time that I got drunk, it was on a Sunday night, it was on a school night, I'll never forget it. The very first time I got drunk, I had a blackout. But what I got from that the next morning was, oh my God, that felt so good. I didn't feel awkward in my own skin. I felt like I fit. I felt like I belonged. Like, all of a sudden, all my problems that a 16-year-old would have melted away, and I felt like I fit in. And so I knew, like, me and alcohol were going to have a long relationship. I knew it right away. I couldn't wait to do that again. Like, I had been missing. This was the missing thing in my life. And in the big book on the bottom of page 33, there's a sentence. I'm just going to paraphrase it because I always get it wrong. But there's a sentence that says something to the effect, potential female alcoholics often cross the line and become the real thing in a very short period of time. Now, how did they know back in the 1930s when the membership was, it was mostly men. I mean, there were some women, but it was mostly men. How did they know to write that? But there it is, the bottom of page 33, because, you know, men are from Mars and women are from Venus, and we're just not wired the same. And so women do cross that line sooner. So by the time I turned 18 years old, I was a full-blown alcoholic, off to the races. And I did manage to graduate high school. I don't know how. I have no idea how I did that. The problems started to come. Like, I would get DUIs. I became unemployable. I couldn't hold a job. I'm drinking on Wednesday night to break up the middle of the week. I'm drinking on Friday. I'm drinking on Saturday. And my blackouts are becoming more frequent. Do we have any blackout drinkers here? Oh, yeah. So, but the thing about the blackout drinker, like for me, was that remorse in the morning, right? When you wake up and the car's not in the driveway, or you don't recognize the wallpaper. And I've done that a lot of times, and I'm not proud of that. I live in near Lake Erie, and there's this little cluster of islands out on Lake Erie. They're actually in the U.S. territory. And one of them is called Put-in Bay, or South Bass is the name of the island. But there's a little village called Put-in Bay where a big war was fought, and there's this big monument. And anyway, it's a party island. And I remember going over there with my girlfriend Lisa one time. This was in the late 1980s. And you have to go on a ferry. And we went over on a Thursday night. And the last memory I have is being in the women's restroom with her. We both ripped off all of our clothes in the restroom. She put on my outfit. I put on her outfit. And we marched back out there and sat down with these guys to see if they would notice that we had switched outfits. And, you know, and it was in August, so it wasn't much, you know, and I was about that big back in the 1980s. And anyway, that's the last memory, cognitive memory that I have. The next memory I have, I open my eyes. I don't recognize the wallpaper. And I look around, and I see that I'm upstairs. I think I'm in a farmhouse. There's lots of trees. I was on Put-in Bay. I was at South Bass Island. I don't know. So I go down this flight of steps, and there's this large, obese man. I weigh about 120 pounds soaking wet. And there's this large, obese man sitting at a kitchen table smoking a big old cigar. And he looks at me, and he said, "Well, there's my sunshine." And I'm like, oh, my God. No. I'm a blackout drinker. Thank God. Oh, no. Right? I got nothing. And I'm like, I hate to ask this, but where exactly are we? He's like, "Oh, honey bunny, this is Middle Bass Island. You're at my house." This guy owned a house, like the next island north. And I'm like, I just need to get back to the mainland because my car is at that ferry dock. And he hopped me in his cigarette boat, his $150,000. And then I realized why I ended up with this obese man because he had a cigarette boat. I don't know, but that's the way I live my life. And so it was Sunday. So 3 days had passed. 3 days passed. I'm not accountable. Nobody knows that I'm missing. I mean, my life is just so out of control. I don't even know where Lisa is. And you know what? I don't care. I'm assuming she got off the island somehow. And just a long history of blackout drinking, coming to, not knowing where I'm at, not knowing what I did, irresponsible, I can't hold a job. I'm constantly losing my driver's license to DUIs, and then the big thing happened in my life, and I'm going to fast forward the tape. I was 28 years old, April 3rd, 1993, and I was with my sister. By now, my sister's the only female left in my inner circle, and I'm sitting on a bar stool in Genoa, Ohio with my sister. It's Friday night. I'm drunk. I'm not in a blackout. I'm not there yet because by now I have a huge tolerance. Like, I could keep up with the boys. I could pound a 12-pack easy and still be in the game. I was a beer drinker. I loved beer. And on this Friday night, I was with my sister. We were sitting on a bar stool. We had been drinking since probably 5 or 6. It's around midnight. And this guy, Tony, that I was dating came in, and he wanted to move to another bar. So I'm all in. We had been bar hopping most of the night anyway. And so he hopped in his Camaro. My sister and I hopped in my Buick. And I was following him down State Route 51. I was about maybe a mile or two from the farmhouse where I had just spent 10 years of my life. I was very close to home. I knew exactly where I was at. I was not in a blackout. But I was drunk. And I was fighting with my sister. And I remember there's one curve in the road on State Route 51. One, it's not even a sharp curve. You don't even have to slow down. But you do need to turn your wheels to the right and navigate through the curve. and was arguing with my sister, and then I entered into the curve, and I was looking at her shouting things and obscenities, and I did not turn my wheels to the right. I just continued to go straight on a forward path, and it's midnight. There's never any traffic on that road at midnight, but there it was. It was a car coming home from a dance at the Woodmore High School. It had three 14-year-old boys in it and a 42-year-old woman driving that car, and I struck that car, and I killed one of those boys in the backseat of that car. And I don't want to paint a picture of a young woman who did not care, but I would say to you that in 1993, I was as sorry and I was as remorseful and I took as much responsibility as I was emotionally capable of doing at that time in my life, because I was messed up. I wasn't right. And so in the ensuing months, it seems to me it was like between 6 and 7 months, because that had happened in April. I had several court appearances. I had like a pretrial and an arraignment and this, that. And every time I turned around, I was on the front page of the Toledo Blade, the Port Clinton News Messenger, the Fremont, or, you know, News Herald. And everybody knew my name all of a sudden. I couldn't even go into a grocery store. And in the summer of 1993, I would continue to drink while I was out on bond waiting to go to prison. And my thought process behind that was, if you had my problems, you'd drink too. But not that I ever needed an excuse to drink. But the truth of the matter is, by the summer of 1993, I didn't have anywhere to turn except to the bottle, because by then, I didn't even have a friend. I didn't even have a friend. And so on October 19th, 1993, Judge Paul Moon in Port Clinton, Ohio, sentenced me to 4 to 10 years. And at that court hearing, the only person I wanted there was my mother. And the boys' family showed up, and then so did Mothers Against Drunk Drivers. They showed up in droves. They came down from Michigan and Indiana and Pennsylvania, and that courtroom had more people that are in this room right now. There were more people there, and that room was smaller than this, and they were packed in like sardines. And then the jury box was full of Channel 13, Channel 11, and just because nothing like that ever happens out where I live. And I didn't know, you know, I sound like the victim here. Boy, it was just as bad as it gets, right? This is my perception. I see things from where I'm at. And but the thing about that morning that stands out in my mind more than anything was when that judge sentenced me, he gave me a 4 to 10 and took my driver's license for the rest of my life. But the thing that sticks out was my mother. I could hear, I know that voice, and I heard her screams echoing off these tall ceilings in the courtroom. Because her baby was going to be hauled off to prison. And she was there to say goodbye. And I'm really ashamed and embarrassed to report to you that I didn't have an ounce of compassion for her or the boy's mom, who was sitting there sobbing hysterically, because her only son was in an early grave. I was so into escaping from that room and getting this thing started that I couldn't feel. I was so numb from my feelings. And the one thing that always made life better, that one thing that would numb this down, I can't have it. My liquid elixir can't have it. And so I ended up in the county jail for like a week while they processed my paperwork, and then it seems to me it was a week or so later, they loaded me up in a paddy wagon and drove me down to Marysville in central Ohio and just dropped me off. And there I was, this sea of 2,000 women. I can't stand women. And I'm in this sea. Women say that from the podium all the time. I've never heard a man come up here and say, boy, I hated men. Right? Do they ever say that? They never say that, but I don't know about down here in Georgia, but up in Ohio, I hear it all the time. I see heads going like this, yeah. And so I'm in this sea of 2,000 women in my game, like the thing that I do, because back in the day I was really cute, and so the thing that I would do would flirt with men. I was like a little flirt, and I was like this little manipulator, and I always got what I wanted, and that's not working here. They don't care. They look at me and they see a felon, and I'm like, was it accident, right? But the truth is, I never talked about my crime, because in the penitentiary, if you've harmed a child, the other inmates find out about that, they'll make your stay extremely difficult. Like, don't hurt the babies. Like, they're not into that. So I, even though it was an accident and he was not a baby, a little child, I would not discuss my crime because I was afraid that they would lock me in that category. So somewhere along the way, this rumor started to circulate that I was some high-ranking executive, some big bank in the state of Ohio, and I'd embezzled all this money, and I was traipsing off to Europe and going off buying yachts, and I loved that rumor. I thought, let them think that, you know what? Because being a girl that stole money from a bank, to me, sounded a whole lot better than being a girl that killed a 14-year-old boy. And I got so much denial going on, and I don't even know. I have no idea that I'm dying with untreated alcoholism because I'm like that boy that's whistling in the dark to keep his spirits up. That's what I'm doing. I'm doing what I got to do to get by in this environment. And some of the weird, quirky behavior patterns that I had developed was the hair and the makeup. You know, it became very, very important every day. Had to do the hair and the makeup. And I had these state uniforms down in Marysville. They had everybody had khaki pants. And then you had to wear that Monday through Friday from 8 to 4. And then your shirt color was based on your status. I was minimum status, so my collar shirt was green. And then the mediums were pink and the maximums were blue. And the supermax was orange shirts. They were usually locked down 23 hours a day. But if you see an orange shirt, oh, my God, go the other way because she's crazy. And so I would iron my khaki pants, and I had little creases, and there I was, you know. And the thought behind all that was if I could just fix up the outside, I could fool you, and you would think I was okay on the inside, and I'm dying on the inside. And so it didn't take long. They moved me to the Northeast Pre-Release Center, downtown Cleveland, Ohio, Cleveland, Ohio's best-kept secret. There's this facility about two or three blocks from where the Cleveland Indians played baseball. It's just off the edge of a freeway by an on-ramp. There are 650 inmates there, some of them serving life sentences that have already been locked up for 30 years. The only requirement to get to go there is be minimum status and be within 4 years of seeing the Ohio Parole Board or going home. That's it. So some of these women that had been locked up for 30 years had worked their status down to minimum, and they were within 4 years of seeing the parole board, so they were eligible to go there. And so they moved me there, and I remember the very day I got there, I was over by my housing unit, and I looked over by this fence. There's a on-ramp right there, and I saw an inmate standing right by the fence. And I thought, oh, my God. And I waited, and I thought, is she going to try to climb that thing? And then a car stopped. This guy gets out of the car. He tossed a bag of weed over the fence. She grabbed it, and I thought, oh, I could do this. I could do time here because this was nothing like Marysville. This was totally, I don't want to say off the hook, but like Marysville was just so strict and so different than the pre-release center. So I started going to AA meetings when I was in Cleveland, first time ever. And the reason I was going to the AA meeting was because I knew that they take attendance there and they were going to put that in my file. And I had this pro hearing coming up in May of 1996, and I thought the Ohio Pro Board might see my attendance at AA meetings, right? Because I was here for an alcohol-related crime, and they might smile on me and let me go home. So I'm going for all the wrong reasons. And I believe it doesn't matter what brings us in here, whether it's a judge or an employer or a spouse, whatever it is, that we got that monkey in our back. How many of us come in here skipping and whistling and so happy to be here? We don't do that. We come in and we usually sit at the back of the room and stare at our watch or our phone and wait for, you know, sometimes we have the little gift certificates that the judge sent. But I'm of the persuasion that seeds are being planted and that guy in the back of the room that doesn't want to be here who's hanging his head, he's probably the most important person in the room. That's just my belief. And so I'm going for all the wrong reasons, and as my pro hearing was drawing near in May of 1996, there was a woman that I kind of got close to. Her name was Denise, and Denise was from the greater Cleveland area, and we had kind of become good friends. Now, her sentence, she did the same thing I did, and her sentence was 2 to 10, and the main reason I believe that she got such a small sentence, the minimum sentence, was because the victim in her accident was her best friend in the passenger seat from childhood, like they had been best friends their whole life. And the victim in her accident that night, her mother had wrote a letter to the Ohio Parole Board and said, we forgive Denise, and we think that she should come home. And so I remember standing outside in the cold Cleveland winter waiting during her parole hearing. It seemed like I was out there all afternoon because they were seeing several inmates that afternoon. And I was out there for about 2 hours, and finally she emerged from the building, and she was pretty upset. And I said, "What just happened in there?" And she said, "They just gave me the whole 10 years day for day." I said, "What?" She said, "They stripped me of the good days that I've earned, and they've set in place that I'll never earn another one. I'm doing 10 years day for day. I'm on my way back to Marysville." What? And they left, took her out of there that day. And then that was like in January. And then maybe a month or two later, a woman from Sandusky, same situation, kind of, sort of. The victim in her accident, though, actually was a man on a bicycle. And on a 5 to 10, she had already served 5 years. On a 5 to 10, she had done 5. So, I mean, she wasn't a troublemaker. I was pretty confident she'd probably get out on a 5. She's done her 5 years. And she came out, and they'd given her the whole 10 years day for day and sent her back to Marysville because she wasn't eligible to be there. I called my mom. I said, "Oh, my God, Mom, they're giving the vehicular homicides the whole 10 years, and I'm going next month." And she said to me something to the effect, "Terry, you'll be fine. Don't compare yourself to them. Maybe they had more than one prior DUI. You know, maybe more than one person was killed. And you're going to be fine. Don't worry about it." And so I get to my first pro hearing in May of 1996. And guess what? Like, I'm not special. I think I'm special, but I'm not special. They had given me the whole 10 years day for day, stripped me of, and I had earned actually a lot of good days. On a 4 to 10, I only had to serve 2 years. I think it was 2 years and 8 months. So I'd had earned like a year and a half of good days already. They took those away and set in place that I can't earn any and drove me back to Marysville that day and dropped me off. And the day they took me back to Marysville, I found myself back in the admissions where you get processed in, where you're locked in a box, just like you see on TV, with a sink, a bunk, and a toilet, waiting to be assigned a bed out in population. And I couldn't even cry. I couldn't even cry. I had just given up 10 years of my life. And, you know, when I look back at that woman, you know, because that's not me. That's not who I am today. But that woman was just so detached from reality, just doing the best she could to get through this situation. And she was like the boy whistling in the dark that day. And so I got back out in population down in Marysville, this maximum security prison for women. I'm wearing khaki pants again with a green shirt that I keep ironing. And it's deja vu all over again. I'm back at that dump. And I had the staff down there fooled. They all thought, "Oh, she's just this nice, sweet girl from the country." You see, I had a high school diploma. If you have that in the penitentiary, that thing is like gold. You will not sling a mop or flip a soy burger. They will find a real job for you. And they had found a real job for me working at the warden's area. So I had my own office. I actually worked in the count office. And the count office is actually a very important place because that's, they count all the inmates like, I don't know, 6 or 7 or 8 times every 24-hour period. There's constantly these counts happening. We have to go to your bed and be at your bed for count. And I worked in the count office. And Lieutenant Wasmer was my boss, and every day I had to report to the count office. Well, one day I typed up all these bed moves. What I was doing was bringing inmates in from admissions. I was doing seniority moves around inside the facility. There were 3 inmate runners that were assigned to me. Their job was to sit on a church pew in the hallway outside my office. And they were that if there was one there, when I would type up all these bed moves or these important documents that I was typing, I would whirl around and say, "I need a runner." And if there was one out there, they were allowed to step in my office and take this document and go with it. Now, if that doesn't feed your ego in the penitentiary, I don't know what will. And there I was, trying to be all I could be in the penitentiary, you know, trying to be a big shot in the penitentiary, you know, and I had, like, the best job there. I really did. I had the best job there. And the staff all liked me, and, you know, I was in cozy with all the white shirts and the warden and, like, anybody that was high ranking. Those are my friends, right? And because that's who I am. That's what I do. And one day I typed up all these bed moves, and I couldn't find Lieutenant Wasmer. And so I went over to the tie office. There was a woman there named Miss Floyd. Miss Floyd was an employee of the state of Ohio. She never wore the same dress twice. Every lock of hair was always in place. She was the epitome of the woman that I wanted to be, except she was the real McCoy, and I was perpetrating a fraud. And so I had walked in her office with all these bed slips, and I said, "Miss Floyd, could you sign off on these?" I had about 30 of them. I said, "It's 3:30. That 4 o'clock count is never going to clear if these inmates don't start, you know, like packing up and getting onto the beds where they're supposed to be. I need to get these slips run fast." And she said, "Oh, yeah, step in my office." And she starts signing away. And she said, "I want to talk to you anyway, Terry." She said, "There's a really good program over at Recovery Services called Hearts. Have you ever thought about treatment?" I said, "Treatment? Treatment for what?" Right? Now, I'm 5 years into my 10-year sentence. I am halfway there. And this woman who works in the office next door to my office saw me every single day. And to her, I was clearly in a lot of pain. She could see. I thought I had up this great wall, this great facade, and actually I was translucent to her because we were in contact so much. And she decided to reach out to me, and I told her, I was honest with her. I said, "Miss Floyd, I said, there's no reason for me to do any programming. I don't get not one good day. 10 years means 10 years. I'm not doing the AA or the victim's awareness or the parenting. I'm not doing any of those programs." And then she said the magic words that my ego just loved to hear. She said, "Well, you know, there's a 2-year waiting list to get into that program, and I can pick up the phone and make a phone call and get you moved into the next group." I said, "Well, sign me up, right?" "I'm moving to the top of a 2-year waiting list. Get it?" She got it. She knew how important I was. That's why she was willing to do that for me. Right? And she had the power. So I said, "You know what? I think I might like to try that." So she made the call, and I got put into the next group. It was about 3 or 4 weeks later. I got moved to the top of a 2-year waiting list. And so what they had to do was reassign my job. So now I'm not a clerk in the count office. I'm not the count office clerk anymore at the warden's area. I'm a student in the HEARTS program. My job title is student. And Monday through Friday, I report to the R&R building. R&R stands for Religious and Recovery Services. And every day, Monday through Friday, from 8 to 4, and there's a break in the middle for account time and lunch. That's my job. That's what I do. And it didn't take me long to figure out how terribly I'd screwed up. This was an intense behavior modification program, and I didn't know anything about it. All I knew was that I was moving to the top of a 2-year waiting list, and that was plenty good enough for me. And so just to set you up, I just kind of want to tell a little story to give you a visual of what this program was like, okay? So there are 16 women in the room, a very small room, about the size of an average bedroom, not a big room. 16 women in the room, 14 of those women are inmates going through the program like me. The 15th inmate, her job title is peer leader. She's called a peer leader. She works for Recovery Services. She's already been through the program. And her function in that circle is to give feedback. And then the 16th woman in that circle is a licensed drug and alcohol counselor. She's employed by the state of Ohio. She gets to go home every night. And so to share with you how the program worked, about a week or two into it, this is like a 4-month-long program, about a week or two into it, one of the women who was in that group with me was locked up because she had killed her daughter. I didn't know if it was true. None of my business. She never talked about her crime, so it was suspicious to me. You see, everybody thought I was there for embezzlement, and I was okay with that. And so one day we came back from lunch, and we circled up around the table, and the counselor looked at that woman and said to her, "I want you to tell the story, to tell these women what you did to your daughter." I remember, like, the hair on my arm stood up. I thought, "Oh, my God. I got to sit here and listen to this. I don't think I could do this." And so she tells a story, and I'm not going to repeat it. I would just say to you, it was as bad as it gets, and it involved water. And so when she got done telling the story, the way the program worked, you place your hands flat on the table and your feet flat on the floor after you share, and you receive feedback. Now, during this woman's feedback process, man, they lit her up. And that feedback went on, I'm not kidding, I'll bet you it went on from 2 o'clock to 4 o'clock for 2 hours. there was shouting, there was screaming. And during the feedback process, when you receive feedback, the way the group is set up, those hands are flat on the table, those feet are flat on the floor, and you do not speak. Your job is to listen. And you might be listening for 2 hours, and they litter up. And I remember sitting there thinking, oh, my God, there's going to be a day when they ask you about what you did, and you're going to be in the hot seat. You see, because I was perpetrating a fraud, everybody thought I was there for embezzlement, and I knew that I wasn't. And that was on Wednesday. Friday, we come back. We circle up around the table. We come back from lunch, and so it was about 1 o'clock. We circled up around the table, and the counselor looked at me, and she said, why don't you tell the story about the night you wrecked your car? And I remember thinking to myself, oh, God, it's going to make it out to the yard that I didn't rob a bank. Like, everybody's going to know that I'm here because I killed a 14-year-old boy. And I expected it, so I sat up straight and I told a story. And interestingly, I was not in a blackout during that accident. I remember all of it. But at this stage, probably upwards of 6 years had passed since the accident. And if the visions of what happened in the road that night would creep into the forefront of my mind, I would quick stuff that down. We're not thinking about that. We're not talking about that. We're not thinking about that. I am not playing that tape in my brain. I wouldn't allow myself to visit that because I didn't know what to do with it because it was so big and so ugly. So for me, that was just a coping mechanism. And so the images of what happened in the road that night were just rusty and just faded from time and from the way that I treated it. And so I pulled out that old reel-to-reel tape, and the images started to play in my mind, and I told a story. And the story was from my perspective, the way that I remembered it. I tried to cry a little bit, act like I was putting my feelings into it, right? But the truth of the matter is I was probably 32 years old at that time, maybe, I don't know, I might have been 34. And I had never uttered a word from my heart at that age. Never. Not even, I love you. I couldn't even say, I love you from my heart. Because everything that came out of my mouth came out of my head. I didn't know how to speak from my heart, right? It's a foreign land to me. It's an emotional thing. It's a feelings disease. I don't handle that. I got two modes, you know. I got fear and I got anger. That's it. Like, that's the old bounce between those two places, fear and anger. And so I told a story. And when I got done telling the story, I sat up straight. I put my hands flat on the table, my feet flat on the floor, and I proceeded to receive my feedback. And my feedback went something like this. Boy, if I didn't know any better, I'd think you were the victim. And you make me sick. You take no responsibility for what you did to that 14-year-old boy. And I can still see that counselor banging her fist on the table. Do you want to save face or save ass? Because you cannot save both. And when she said that, like, I got that. Understood what I was trying to do. And what I was trying to do was save face, sugarcoat it. It's just not that bad, right? And my feedback went on for a couple of hours, and it just seemed to me like every time somebody opened up their mouth and hurled an insult at me, it just seemed to me like, because I had this wall up, obviously, and they just had like hammers and just chisels and picks, and they just kept banging at my wall all afternoon. It went on for like 2 hours. And at one moment on that Friday afternoon, it just seemed to me, and I don't know, I can't tell you what comment it was, I don't know who it was, but somebody said something. And I had this one brief moment of clarity where it just seemed to me like a beam of light, just a ray, like a laser, came through that wall and pierced me right there in my chest, deep enough that it hit my soul. And I had this one moment where I sat up and I went, oh my God, what have you done? Like it was encapsulated, and I could see it clearly in its true reality for what it was for a whole tenth of a second. And then I shut that down because we are not going to get vulnerable in this moment when all these women are attacking me. That ain't happening, right? And I kept staring at that clock, because I knew when the 4 o'clock whistle would blow, I could jump up. I had to go back. Like we all, and it was Friday. We all had to go back for count time. And finally the whistle did blow, and I jumped up and grabbed my book, and that counselor looked at me and she said, not so fast. When you get back to your room, I want you to write a letter to that 14-year-old boy. And I'm all crying and teary-eyed, and I don't know what to say. And everything will be all wrong anyway. There's no point in me writing him a letter because it will just be wrong. And she said, you know what, I'm not going to tell you what to say. Just write him a letter and bring it to group on Monday. And one more thing, when you get back to your room, I want you to wash off that makeup. I don't want to see any more makeup on you. I'm placing you on makeup restriction for the next 2 weeks. Right? I've never had that response ever. You guys, I love you guys. You get that. Like, yay, Atlanta. People are still staring at me going, what? Makeup restriction? What is that? So anyway, and I'm mad. She says makeup restriction, and I'm mad because what I heard was, we're peeling your mask off, girlfriend. We're going to get down to what's underneath that. Who are you? Who are you? I don't know. But I guess we're about to find out. So I get back to my room. I hopped up on my bed and I start to write a letter to a 14-year-old boy that had changed my life. And I said things like, you're never going to go to your senior prom with a girlfriend. You're not going to graduate high school. You're not going to get your driver's license. You're not going to go to college. You're not going to have a career. You'll never have an opportunity to build a house. You're not going to buy your first car. I have taken all these things away from you and so much more. And that letter was 4 pages front and back, and it just poured off that pen. I couldn't record the words fast enough that was spewing up out of my soul. Because, see, what had happened in that treatment program, they had just gashed it open. And I just was having this emotional vomit, like all this stuff was just coming out of me, and I was recording it on this letter to this kid, how I really felt and what it looked like. And over the course of that weekend, I felt a shift was happening. I remember the colors being so much brighter. I don't know why that stands out to me. I remember going to the cafeteria on Saturday, and some of the inmates that had on their state shirts, like the pink ones, particularly the pink and a couple orange shirts, were just so bright. And on page 30, my favorite line in the big book is on page 30. Bill Wilson writes, "We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were an alcoholic." Our innermost selves. And if I said to you, where is that? Where is this place? Because I don't know about my innermost self. I spend my time up here. And this is a dangerous place because this is where my ego's at. My disease is here. There's all these committees up here. I don't know how to get out of my head and go down into my heart. I don't know how to get from there to there. It's only 12 inches, but it's the longest journey of a lifetime for me. And that was my journey of recovery. And so on Monday morning, we get back to group. We circle up around the table, and I looked at the counselor. I said, I've got my letter. She said, that's good. I said, well, I want to read it. She said, you will read it. But before you read the letter, I want to revisit group on Friday. I want you to tell the story about that night you wrecked your car, but this time, I want you to tell the truth. Man, you could have knocked me over with a feather. I thought, I can't possibly go through that again. And then the next thought that right behind it was, screw it. I'm never going to see these women again. Just tell the story. You see, because the truth of the matter is, I'm a stuffer. I've been all my life, you know, and particularly the last 5 years, I would stuff it down, stuff it down, stuff it down, stuff it down. And over the course of that weekend, all that stuff kept coming up and coming up and coming up. It was right here in my throat. I was choking on my own crud. Like I just needed to have an emotional vomit right there on the table, and I went for it. And I told a story. And that story that I told Monday morning was the exact same story I told Friday. The facts of what happened in the road that night will never change. But what was different about Monday morning was the perspective. Because, see, I don't see things the way that they really are. I see things the way that I am. And the way that I am had shifted from Friday to Monday. In the course of a weekend, a miracle had happened in my life. And I told a story about what really happened in the road. And what really happened was there was a hysterical woman, Jane Miller, his mother, a registered nurse at St. Charles Hospital in Toledo, Ohio. Hysterical. In the road. And that woman ran away from her car about 50 yards. And she stopped and she bent over and she grabbed her knees. And that woman let out a scream that I can still hear today, 26 years later. because her only son was bleeding to death in the back seat of her car, and she could not save his life. That's what I did. And I own that. And so when I got done telling that story, I looked up. I looked at the counselor and I said, I put my hands flat on the table and my feet flat on the floor. And she said, before we do the feedback, I want you to read your letter. Right? So I read this letter that I had wrote on Friday afternoon to that kid. When I got done reading the letter, that was when I looked up and I saw all those eyes of compassion looking back at me. And it was the very first time in my entire life that I felt like I wasn't being judged. Nobody's going to try to attack me. That this is a safe place to go ahead and let that stuff go and to leave it in this room. Because all the other women in that circle were crying too. We were all crying together. And it just seemed to me that there was a healing moment. And the tears that they were shedding actually weren't for me or for the boy. We silently, unconsciously give each other permission to go down and touch our own stuff when we relate or connect to somebody else. And that was happening on steroids in that room that morning, right? And so I finished the program. I'm just going to fast forward here. I finished the program. I ended up taking a job at Recovery Services. They offered me a job, and I thought, you know what? My ego does not need me at the warden's area. My soul and my disease needs me over here. So I took a job. So I wasn't one of the peer leaders. They actually put me in charge of, I was doing all the meetings during the day. So I had set up all the chairs, chair the meeting. So like Monday might have been a 12 and 12. Tuesday could have been a big book study. There was a format Monday through Friday of the afternoon meetings. That was for the people that worked in second shift so that they could go if they wanted to during the day. And then I was doing the admissions program. The women, they had AOD, which is alcohol and other drugs. Was a program that was every inmate in the state of Ohio had to go through AOD. It was 10 hours of training, so I was doing that, which probably prepared me a little bit for this in a way, because I was every day, every morning, I was in front of a large group of people speaking. I never give that any thought till right now. Isn't that weird? Oh, wow, okay. And so I found myself getting really active, working the steps, and the girl Sheila, she was the peer leader that went through my program with me. And so Sheila and I would sit out in the yard, and Sheila had a twinkle in her eye. She'd been locked up longer than me. She'd been locked up probably 8 or 9 years. I think I'd been locked up 6. But there was something about Sheila that I wanted, and Sheila had a spiritual foundation, and I didn't know anything about that. And one day we're sitting out in the yard, and we start talking about God, and I am your Sunday morning speaker, so we're going to have a conversation about God, right? And so we're sitting out in the yard, and we start talking about God, and I'm like, this is not, and I believed in God. It wasn't that I didn't believe in God, but this is not going to work for me. And so right away, her red flags are going up. She goes, what do you mean? How could this, God is for every, no, he's not. And she goes, what do you, why? And I said, Sheila, seriously, like for real? What kind of a God would have let that boy die in that accident that night? Why not me? And she said, are you serious? I said, yes. And she said, I think you're asking the wrong question. You need to be asking, what kind of a 28-year-old woman would get behind the wheel of a car, intoxicated, and place in jeopardy the lives of everybody else on the road that night? And I thought, yeah, you know what? Okay, I'll give you that. here's a good one, and I did say this to her. What kind of a God would let all those babies in Ethiopia starve? And we've all seen the pictures with little arms about that big around, and it makes me sick when I see those. Something in me moves. And she said, what? I said, yeah. She goes, you blame that on God? I said, yes, I do. I do blame that on God. God could create the manna, like he grow bananas or something. Like he could, he's God. He could create food, give them trees. And she said, I'm going to tell you something. There is no dearth of food on this planet. There is no reason that anybody should ever have to go to bed hungry. There's no shortage of food. We don't distribute it, right? So don't ask what kind of a God would let the babies in Ethiopia starve. You need to be asking what kind of people. And I had this epiphany. And I got it in that moment. Something in me shifted. I was like, oh my God. Like my whole life, I blamed God for everything. And the truth of the matter is that God works through people, right? And so she just asked me some very basic fundamental questions about God. Where do you think he is? I don't know. I suppose he's in heaven. Oh, that's good. Where do you think heaven is? I don't know. I suppose it's up there, out there somewhere. Okay. What do you think he's doing? I don't know. He's godding. Like, what does God do? Right? I mean, he's really busy answering all these prayer requests and making the earth rotate around the sun and making, you know, embryos into babies and acorns into oak trees. And I don't know. But what I do know is that he doesn't have time for a scumbag like me. And she said, oh, scumbag like you. What do you really think he's doing? I said, what I really think he's doing is he's got a list. He's got the good side and he's got the bad side. And I know where I fall because of what I had done. You see, I really thought that God's function was to decide who gets to go to heaven and who gets to go to hell. That's what I really thought. And I thought that hell was this very real place and that you really do burn for eternity. And I honestly thought that everybody in the United States believed what I believed, that we all had the same belief about God because that's the way that we grew up in the United States. That's how screwed up I was. And so she actually said, you know what, Terry, I think that you should scrap everything you think you know about God. What? You could do that? Like, that just seems so blasphemous. It just seemed like you can, I could do that? She said, oh, I encourage it in your situation. I'm like, oh. Okay. So if I just throw all that in the trash and get rid of that, because that obviously, because I can't snuggle up. You guys are telling me I need to get a God of my understanding and snuggle up to and have a relationship with. I can't have that. That is not working for me. And she saw that, and she said, Terry, I just want you to say a simple prayer. Ask God to direct your thoughts, your words, and your deeds. Say it in the morning and say it at bedtime. I love the one that we heard over the weekend, whatever and enough. I'd never heard that before, but mine wasn't quite like that. Mine was, ask God to direct your thoughts, your words, and your deeds. So I'm saying this prayer in the morning. I'm saying it at night. That's all she asked me to do. And I did it for like 30 days. And we got back together in the yard. She asked me, how does that feel? I said, awkward. I feel like I'm just talking to the wall. She said, good, keep doing that. And so I kept doing that because she told me to do it. And she had a sparkle in her eye. And I started reading some books, and I wasn't much of a, I mean, I know how to read, but I wasn't much of a reader. I didn't have time. I was incarcerated and didn't have time to sit down and read. I can't figure. I don't know. And so I started reading some books, and our big book does tell us that we should ask our rabbi, our minister, or our priest about what other books might be helpful to us. So based on that sentence in the big book, I was actually over at the library in the penitentiary. There was a big library in the R&R building, and there was this pretty book. It was had this pretty cover. It had like a forest and trees and the sky, and it said, Conversations with God. I thought, oh, it was just so pretty. And at that time, interestingly, that book was on the New York Times bestseller list. This was like back in 96. That book, every book in that library was like 40 years old. But there was this book that was currently on the New York Times bestseller list. So I checked it out, and I read it, and I couldn't set it down. And I'm not promoting that book. I mean, it was helpful to me, but I just want to say that that book introduced me to a God that I could fall in love with. And what I found out was that God's not up there, out there somewhere, because if I was right, and that's true, and God really is up there, out there somewhere, then we're separate, because he's up there, out there, I'm down here, there's this space in between us, right? And so what I found out is that you cannot separate yourself from God. God is inside all people, inside of us, waiting to be acknowledged, waiting to be tapped into. There's this paradise inside of us, and I'm running from it instead of trying to run to it. And I know that it's inside of us. Like, for instance, tonight when we go to sleep, everybody's fingernails are going to grow just a little bit. Like, right now in this moment, everybody's heart's beating, and you don't get the credit for that. That's not you. Make it stop. You can't, because you don't have any control over it. Do you know why your heart's beating right now in this moment? Because it's the will of God. That's why. That's why it's beating. And that's that energy, that's that life force. And that thing, this energy, this life force, this is just my truth. If it doesn't resonate, if it doesn't apply, let it fly. But that thing, that life force that is making your heart beat is connecting us, because it's in all of us. We've all got it. And it's not just in humans. It's in plants and it's in animals and it's everywhere. And so when I was a little girl, I remember them saying things like, you know, trying to get me to be good. God's everywhere. God sees everything you do. Yep, sure does. Because God is everywhere and God does see everything. You want to know what the face of God looks like? Turn and look at the person to your right. Do you want to know what the face of God looks like? Turn and look at the person to your left. God is inside people. He's in people. When I switched my perspective to that, that was a game changer for me. That lit up the whole spiritual program for me. The whole thing started to come to life. And then I started to pray to a God that wasn't up there, out there somewhere, but to a God that was in my heart. And then I started to fall in love. And I started to develop some self-esteem. I started to feel a little bit better about me. I started to feel a little bit better about that woman looking back at me in the mirror. Because I knew who was in there. I knew who was in there. And we get introduced to our true self. That is the whole thing about step 12, right? Having had a spiritual awakening, right? That's the goal. Anybody can be sober. Go out there and punch a cop. I guarantee you, you'll have 30 days at minimum. Plug in the jug, done. Anybody can stop drinking. That's not what we're doing here. That's just a tiny part of the whole equation. We're not just stopping drinking. We're having a spiritual awakening. That is the true gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what we do. And so I want to keep moving on. So I end up back at the Northeast Pre-Release Center at year 8. I think I had maybe between two and three years left on my sentence. Back at the Northeast Pre-Release Center, I am a different woman. I am not the same woman that was sent back to Marysville with her whole 10-year sentence. And as soon as I get off the bus, I run over to Recovery Services, which is a tiny little office about the size of my bathroom. And there's one woman named Miss Daniels, and she's trying to service 650 inmates out of this dinky little office the size of my bathroom. And I walked in that office. I said, Miss Daniels, I said, I'm back. She said, well, hi, welcome back. And I said, do you have any books or literature, anything that would be helpful? Because I'm a reader now. Now I got time to read, and I want to read. And she walked over to the shelf, and she pulled down off a shelf this box about this big. And she wasn't in the program. She didn't even know what she had. I didn't even know what she had. But she hands it to me, and she said, this Joe and Charlie workshop might be helpful to you. Swear to God, true story. So she hands me the Joe and Charlie workshop on because it was 10 cassette tapes. She hands that to me, and I go back to my cell, the 4 o'clock count. Everybody's got to sit on their bed for 45 minutes every day at 4 o'clock. So at 4 o'clock count, I put on my headset, put in cassette number 1, push play. It took me about 2 minutes before I realized, oh, my God, like I got a little pot of gold. This is the good stuff. Oh, my God. Because I was so limited. Like what I, you know, the people, I couldn't just call a sponsor. I didn't really have one, kind of, sort of. I couldn't call a sponsor. I couldn't just go to a meeting when I needed to go to a meeting. I couldn't, like, I was so limited in what I had, but I had those tapes. And so I found myself every day for 2 years at 4 o'clock listening to Joe and Charlie, and they took me through the steps for the first time. And if you said to me, who was your first sponsor, I would say it was Joe and Charlie, because I did the steps under the direction and guidance of Joe and Charlie. And I would see Miss Daniels at the Tuesday night AA meeting, and periodically I would ask her, do you need those tapes back yet? And she would always say the same thing. Are you still using them? I use them every single day at 4 o'clock. Just hang on to them. I had those things in my possession until I was released. And my special day came on October 19th, 2003. It was on a Sunday morning. It was in the fall. All the leaves were turning in Cleveland, Ohio. And my mom was out in the parking lot. It was 8 a.m. And I remember thinking to myself, oh, my God, kid, this is where the rubber meets the road. Did I mean what I said? Was I honest enough? Did I get enough? I guess I was kind of doing a sixth step as I was walking towards the gate, you know? is there something left undone that I need to be doing? And the answer was yes. I need to go to an AA meeting, and it's urgent. Like, it has to happen today. It cannot wait. It has to be my number one priority. And so, I knew that. I instinctively knew that. And so earlier in the week, I had gone over to see Miss Daniels, and I turned in those cassette tapes, and I said, how do I get a hold of the people from AA? How will I know who they are? How do I find the meetings? And she gave me a phone number of my local central office in Toledo, and she wasn't in the program. She goes, I don't know if they'll answer on a Sunday, but take and call this number and tell them that you just got out of prison. You need to get to an AA meeting. I'm like, okay. So I did what she told me to do, and as soon as I got home, I called that number, and somebody answered the phone. And I told that woman I had just got out of prison. I don't know where the meetings are. I don't have a car. And she said, where are you at? I said, I'm out in Woodville, because she was in Toledo. She said, stay by your phone. Give me your number. Stay by your phone. Someone's going to call you in a few minutes, within 10 minutes. I'm like, okay. It wasn't. 5 minutes later, that phone rang, and it was a woman. And she said, asked me who I was, my address. She said, I'm going to pick you up tonight at 7 o'clock. I said, okay. And she took me to my AA meeting, my first AA meeting in Fremont, Ohio, where I was able to introduce myself, and I said, my name is Terry, I'm an alcoholic. I just got out of prison this morning after serving 10 years. Oh, everybody goes, oh! And I'm not joking. And I don't know where the meetings are, I don't have a car. All I know is I don't want to drink, and I need help. Those women were like vultures. Newcomer! And she's serious! And I was serious. I had worked so hard to get to the place that I was at. And then there was Linda. And Linda, I like to refer to her as the air traffic controller. Linda, after that meeting, she was like, tomorrow night, you're going to take her to the Genoa group. I'm going to take her on Tuesday to the Gibsonburg group. You're going to pick her up and take her. And she was telling everybody what they're in. And I'm just standing there going, because I didn't have anything else to do. I didn't know where the meetings were. And so I was going to a meeting every single day upon my release. And that was so good for me, because I was able to meet my AA community. And so let me speed along just a little bit. So there's a funny story I want to tell real quick. So on the way home from the penitentiary, we were driving west on the Ohio Turnpike. I hadn't been in public in 10 years. I kind of feel like I got a little tattoo right here that says felon. It's right there. And actually, it's red. So we stop at this McDonald's, and we're going to get a coffee and a potty break. And I, for the very first time in 10 years, I step into a public arena. We're standing in the line at McDonald's. I look down. My mom pulls some cash out of her purse. And I looked down and I saw that cash, and I said, my God, what happened to the money? And my mom looks at me with real big eyes, cashier's looking at me, the line gets quiet, my tattoo's flashing red. And she goes, what do you mean? I said, well, it had these great big giant heads on it. I couldn't tell a 5 from a 10. I didn't even think it was U.S. money. Like, U.S. it didn't even look like U.S. currency. And I thought, I'm just going to keep my mouth shut. And so we go in the restroom. This all happened in, like, the span of 10 minutes. We go in the restroom, and she beat me out, and I approach the sink, and I walk up. I want to wash my hands. How do you turn the water on? She said, just stick your hand under the faucet. I said, what? So I stuck my hand under the faucet, and the water poured. Unbelievable. That is a true story. That is a true story. Welcome home, Terry. Things have changed. So I took a job at the local grocery store in downtown Woodville, Ohio, a place that I could walk to. I got this little apartment above the plumbing shop, and I had this little apartment. I was living by myself, walking to the grocery store a few blocks away, scanning groceries. And in Woodville, everybody knows everybody. Everybody knew what I did. Everybody knew where I had gone. But everybody didn't know I was coming home. And there I was to scan that gallon of milk and take their money. And that raised a lot of eyebrows when people would walk in that grocery store and see me standing there. And I just smile. I never once said to anybody, I've changed. You should give me a second chance. I'm not the same woman that left here. Because I knew, what a waste of energy. What a waste of breath. People don't want to hear that. They want to see it. Don't tell me, show me. And my actions demonstrated that I had, in fact, changed. And so I'm scanning groceries at the local grocery store. An old friend came in and said, the eye doctor across the street's going to hire somebody. And I said, eye doctor? I said, I don't know anything about eyes. Oh, you don't have to. Can you answer a phone and schedule an appointment? Yeah, I could probably do that. That's what they need. They need someone to help their brother. The optician on staff is the person that you, after your eye exam, that does your glasses and checks you out. And they probably do your insurance. I don't know. And so they needed someone to help the optician who had polio as a young child and drug one of his legs. And I thought, well, God, I could probably do that. Then I made the mistake of telling the air traffic controller about it. And so about a month later, Linda had said to me, what happened when you went into that eye doctor? She goes, I forgot about that. I said, oh, I'm going to waste his time. She said, oh, no, that's not how this works. She said, when I pick you up Friday for that anniversary in Toledo that we're going to, you're going to tell me all about it, how it went. So you have all week to go in there. I was like, great, me and my big mouth. And so Wednesday when I got off work, I suited up and I showed up, and it was right across the street from the eye doctor or from the grocery store where I worked. I went in there and I approached the desk. The only person in there was Bill, the optician, the man that had the polio, an older man, like, I don't know, later 60s. And I stuck out my hand and I said, my name is Terry. I understand you're going to hire somebody and I'd like to apply for that position. And I said, but before we do that, there's something that I need to tell you. And that old man jumped up out of that chair and he grabbed my hand and he said, oh, for Pete's sakes, this is a small town. I already know about that. I've been waiting on you for a month. Where have you been? True story. So what happened was Dr. Lobb and his brother Bill were asking the patients, mostly residents of Woodville, we're going to hire someone to help Bill. Who would you recommend? My name kept coming up. Not only was my name coming up, but the community was endorsing me and saying, we think she'd be really good over here. They had already made a decision. They were probably going to hire me if I would just show up. So do you see how I've got fear holding me back, and the Holy Spirit had already gone before me and made the crooked way straight? So the moral of that story is, fear's a liar, okay? Fear is a liar. So now I'm working two jobs. I work at the grocery store, working for the eye doctor. And about a year and a half, maybe 2 years into that, Bill, the optician who taught me everything I know about glasses, I had the best teacher in the world, suddenly got sick. He developed bone cancer right here in his jaw and was dead within 2 months. And Bill's death really changed my life because then I went from part-time to full-time. I was the only employee there next to Dr. Lobb, who was only there 2 days a week. And I'm not working at the grocery store anymore because I'm full-time at the eye doctor. And after Bill's funeral, when the dust settled, Dr. Lobb came to me and said, I need you to be licensed by the state of Ohio. You're going to study this, and then you're going to go to Columbus in the spring and take a test. And I'm like, oh, my God. I was just so panic-stricken because I'm not good with numbers at all. Like, if you were here for the trivia, the big book thing, you will see that the question was, what was the big celebration in 1960 in Long Beach, California? What was AA celebrating? Oh, duh. From 1935 to 1960. So I said, the 35th anniversary. No, it was the 25th. I can't even do simple math. And your prescription is all numbers. And I'm like, oh, my God, I can't do this. And I just worked really hard. And I studied and I practiced and I worked and I studied and I practiced. And I went down to Columbus and I took that test and I passed it. I'm a licensed optician in the state of Ohio. That's my trade. That's what I do. Thank you. That wouldn't be possible. None of that would be possible if it weren't for God and Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just a bum from Woodville. I really was a scumbag. Seriously. And so I'm working for the eye doctor, and then I start dating this guy, Eric Cruz, who I went to high school with. His mom was my English teacher, and he was super safe. He was kind of nerdy, really smart, went to OSU, got this great education, grew up in a normal Beaver Cleaver. Like, Eric just naturally knows the next right thing to do, and I have to think about it. You know, it doesn't just roll off my brain. Like, I pause. What would Eric do? What would Jesus do? I don't know. So anyway, we started dating, and I never dated anybody else. Like, I came home, and actually my first priority was Alcoholics Anonymous, and then to get settled in a job. Like, dating was at, like, number 12 on a list of things to do. And I was probably home 6 or 8 months before I went on my first day. I wasn't ready. I didn't want to do that. And I went out with Eric, and we had so much fun, and he was so safe. And I kept going out with him, and the next thing I knew, I married him. And I live in this pretty brick house on the Portage River in Woodville, and I got this optician license, and I'm walking to work every day. It's 0.8 miles one way, so I'm walking almost 2 miles every day, rain, sleet, snow, didn't matter. And I'm sponsoring now a large group of women who are really good about taking their sponsor to AA meetings because I can't drive, right? And I'm starting to speak a little bit more because God is God's got a plan for my life, and I don't know what that is. All I know is my job is to get up in the morning and suit up and show up, and I say a simple prayer every morning. I say the third step prayer, a regular prayer, and then I add something like, where would you have me go, what would you have me say, and to whom, right? Just keep, do that every day. Where would you have me go? What would you have me say? And to whom? That's turning it over. And then just keep that there. Just keep that right there. And so I've said that prayer all the time. And next thing I know, I find out that there's this law in the books in the state of Ohio that had been on the books since January 1st of 2004 for people who have a lifetime suspension, because he didn't have any remedy. I never had a remedy for my driving problem. Now there's this remedy on the books in the state of Ohio, and I'm reading it online going, what? So I printed it. I took it home. I showed it to my husband. He's like, oh, we're going to hire you attorney. So we make this phone call. We get this attorney who happens to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and Bill's like, let me do some research. I'll get back with you. I'm like, okay. So about a week later, he gets back with me. He goes, here's the deal. Since 2000, it's 2010. So in the last 6 years, only I could find eight cases in the state of Ohio who have filed under that. Eight? That's all? He goes, yeah, and it gets worse. I'm like, okay. He goes, nobody's got relief under it. What? And he's like, yeah, because, you know, 15 years have to pass. So one of them only, like, 10 years had passed, and there were all these reasons why these other eight cases, and I'm like, oh, my God. I go, Bill. He's like, no, we could do this. We could do this. So the criteria was 15 years have to pass. If the reason they were taken for life were drug and alcohol related, that you've had treatment. There was like this criteria of 10 things, and I fit them all. So we had this hearing in 2010, and the media showed up. Channel 11, Channel 13, Toledo Blade. It was pretty crazy. And my attorney had told me, I need you to fill the courtroom. Just fill it. And I'm like, okay. So I'm telling everybody I know before meetings and after meetings, would you come to my hearing and support me? Would you come support everybody? Oh, my God, you guys turned out in droves. It looked just like it did in 1993, except all the people in that room didn't want my blood. They wanted me to succeed. They were on my side. And what an incredible switch 17 years later. And the boy's mom showed up, and she got on the witness stand, and under oath, that boy's mom said, I know for a fact that this woman still drinks and drugs, and you cannot restore her driving privileges and put public safety at risk. And she was very angry, and I sat at that defendant table, and I listened to her, because I know that it's not for me to say how long her grieving process should last, or even if she should ever forgive me. She can say things that and speak things about me that are pleasing to her, and that was pleasing to her to say that, and I am okay with that. And so at the end of that hearing, he issued his decision 2 weeks later. He did not restore my driving privileges. What he gave me was an ankle monitor. And I was 17 years sober, wearing an ankle monitor in the summertime. And back then, it was like a pack of cigarettes. It was this big, giant. It was very noticeable. People would say, Terry, what is that on your ankle? Oh, that's just my house payment. That's all that is. Because that thing was expensive. And so I did the ankle monitor for like 3 months. Once that came off, then I was dropping urines and doing breathalyzers. And I don't have outside issues. Alcohol is it. That's my thing. I don't have any outside issues. But there I am being drug tested. Okay, whatever. We'll do that. And I did that for 3 years. And I went back after 3 years. And that judge, I can still see him. Well, what he did initially was, he restored a partial license. I had the right to drive to work, AA, and anything relating to Alcoholics Anonymous, which would include the airport, which was huge, because when I started speaking, I couldn't drive. So somebody had to drive me from Woodville up to Detroit, drop me off, and then deadhead back in an empty car. That was 3 hours out of somebody's day on Friday. And then Sunday, somebody got to do it again. So it was 6 hours for me so that I could go speak. And so anyway, I was so happy to have just that little bit. And then he said, we're going to come back in 3 years. So we came back in 3 years, and then I can still see him. He held up this document, this piece of paper, and said to the courtroom, I have scientific data right here that backs up her claim that she is, in fact, drug and alcohol free. I have 3 years worth of testing, and I'm going to rely on this as evidence that she is, in fact, who she says she is. And it's in the interest of justice to restore her driving privileges. And he lifted all the restrictions that I have, and I have a valid Ohio driver's license. I know. And I want to say that that just happened. That just happened in July of last year. And in fact, it's been right about a year ago. And but I want to, there's a story I want to share. Am I getting close? Am I good? Oh, I got 5 minutes. Okay. I'm just going to leave you with this story. Because if I tell the other story, we're just going to drag out 10 minutes, and then the taper's going to be mad at me. So we're just going to leave it with this story. I don't know how to make an amends for this thing. How do you make an amends? So during our step process, let's just say I'm your neighbor and I break your window when I'm drunk because you blew your leaves in my yard and I threw rocks and I broke your window. And a couple years later, I get sober and you end up on my fourth and fifth step. And then you end up on my 8 and 9. And my sponsor says, you know, you need to go make an amends to your neighbor for breaking that picture window that one time. I'd be like, yeah. So going over and telling the neighbor, I'm sorry I broke your window, is a great beginning on making an amends to him. But that's not it. Because further action is required. In addition to telling him, I'm sorry, I broke his window, I need to replace the window that I broke and stop throwing rocks, right? So the window that I've broken cannot be replaced. How do you breathe life into a dead person? I can't do that. My sponsor said I would make an amends through right living by consistently doing the next right thing. And that might mean setting up tables. It might mean I'm the coffee girl on Wednesday nights, you know. Earl was talking a lot about service. That's my gig. People know, don't touch that coffee pot, because I'm on that coffee pot. That's what I do, and I make good coffee. And I clean that pot. When that meeting's over, I clean the pot. And people come, that's an opportunity. The people that want to talk to me, they come back into the kitchen. They know Cherry's in the kitchen by herself cleaning the pot, and I get a chance to talk to people. And so we give service in a lot of ways. I give back in a lot of ways. And I was in I was in Reno, Nevada back in April, not long ago, just a few months ago. I was in Reno, Nevada. And this short little woman gets in the thank you line. And you just never know who's going to get in that thank you line. You just never know what they're going to say. And this woman got in that thank you line, and she reached out, and she took my hands into her hands, and she was short. I'm only 5'2", so she must have been about 4'10". And she looked up at me, and she said, I just want to say to you that 26 years ago, my 14-year-old son was killed by a drunk driver in my front yard. And I want to say to you, I'm pretty sure that that boy's mom is never going to forgive you based on what you said, but I want you to know that I forgive you. And I just welled up with tears, and I thanked her, and I said, thank you so much. I think I needed to hear that. And then she said to me, I think I needed to say it. So thank you for letting me share my experience, strength, and hope. My name is Terry Cruz. Thank you.